The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Democrats put together a $1.9 trillion stimulus package.
But a whole lot of this bill has zero to do with COVID.
We'll look at where the money is going.
This is a COVID bill held hostage by a gigantic honeypot of progressive dreams.
Biden has the gun industry hopping.
Well, what's really interesting to me is the amount of women that continue to outpace men in purchasing guns and being new gun owners and being out in the range and learning how to shoot and taking lessons.
And a young college graduate takes on her school.
Stop demanding that I admit to white privilege and work on my so-called implicit bias as a condition of my continued employment.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. Democrats are pushing through a $1.9 trillion so-called relief package. Theoretically, it's to help jumpstart an economy deflated by the pandemic. In reality, that is a small part of this legislation. Democrats are using their total power to ram through a massive bill loaded with progressive spending dreams. President Biden and the Democrats did not take long to abandon the unity agenda. Senator Ted Cruz joined me this week on The Hugh Hewitt Show. This is a nightmare bill. This is so inflationary. Will Joe Manchin join you in scaling this back? Because it's a disaster for the economy, and no less a person than Larry Silver has said so. Former president of Harvard. So are we going to pare that down to a normal number?
In anything resembling a world of sanity, the answer would be yes. Unfortunately, we are in a world where the Democrats have control of both houses. The chances of the House doing that, I think, are zero. I think Pelosi will crack the whip and everyone will fall in line. In the Senate, we're 50-50. And so this, like so many other things for the next 2 years, comes down to Joe Manchin. Listen, I've served with Joe for 8 years. He's a very nice guy. He's affable. Everyone likes Joe. It's hard not to like Joe. His history in the Senate is that his rhetoric is quite moderate. And yet, in the time I've served in the Senate, I cannot think of a single time he has stood up to Chuck Schumer on any issue of consequence when it made a difference. In other words, the sort of joke among Republicans is that Manchin will sometimes vote with us when it's not the deciding vote. But at least if past is prologue, he hasn't done so when it is the deciding vote. I hope that changes. I would love to see Joe press back on Schumer and Pelosi and Biden, but I don't know if Schumer has thumb screws or a medieval rack in his office, but at least in the past, Democratic senators have been unwilling to cross Schumer and they enforce strict party discipline. The Republicans, look, I'm going to vote no on this monstrosity, but if they hold their 50 Democrats and Kamala Harris, they will get it through. And I'll point out they're also abusing the parliamentary rules and trying to ram through entirely different provisions that have nothing to do with COVID. A whole lot of this bill has zero to do with COVID. This is all about paying off left-wing special interests. This is about paying off teachers' union bosses. This is about paying off their buddies in blue states that have dug themselves a debt hole. And one of the consequences, they're trying to push through a $15 minimum wage as part of this, which if that happens, the projections are 1.4 million Americans will lose their jobs. So the early legacy of the Biden administration, on day one, he destroyed 11,000 jobs of the Keystone Pipeline, destroyed 8,000 union jobs. And on month two, if they do this, they're going to destroy another 1.4 million jobs, predominantly low-income young people, especially African-Americans and Hispanics, who tend to be in the jobs that are vulnerable to being destroyed by the policies they're pushing forward.
Jerry Boyer is an economist and the author of the new book, The Maker Versus the Takers, What Jesus Really Said About Social Justice and Economics. He discussed the COVID package with my colleague out in Cleveland, Bob France, from AM 1420, The Answer.
Jerry, how on earth do Democrats justify this bill when so many Americans are really truly in need of actual COVID relief?
Because they think they're saving the world. That's how they justify it. So, you know, having a kind of a distant relationship with the truth is a small price to pay ethically if you think the earth is going to burn up. And that, you know, America is right on the verge of tilting into Nazism unless we get the right kind of diversity re-education. So they believe that, you know, bills like this are the difference between heaven on earth and hell on earth. So they'll lie, especially if you're a moral relativist. It's a lot easier to lie. But, of course, it is a lie. This isn't a COVID bill. This is a COVID bill held hostage by a gigantic honeypot of progressive dreams. And the idea is that if Republicans vote no, we're voting no on COVID vaccines when we really would be voting no on, you know, preserving ancient Cherokee or the Green New Deal or whatever pieces of it they think they can get through. So it's a play for political power. It's an act of political manipulation. And by the way, the markets see what's going on. Bond yields are going up. Why? Because if I'm going to lend you money and I'm afraid that when you pay me back, the dollars will be worth a lot less, I need a higher interest from you to compensate me for the risk of the loss of purchasing power. So that's why bond yields go up when inflation fears go up, because it's another risk that the markets have to account for. So the markets are always telling the truth, even when the politicians are lying. And the markets, through $55,000 Bitcoin and, you know, recent spikes in gold and a weak dollar and rising interest rates, are all screaming, we can't afford this. And they're right.
First, I want to thank you for this new addition to my vernacular, having a distant relationship with the truth. That's the best way to describe a lie that I've heard in a long time, so I'm going to add that one. Jerry, talk to me about some of the impacts on the economy, and if you want to tie it to the markets or not. We all know there's the actual, you know, Main Street economy as well as the markets, but of some of the things in the bill that have nothing to do with COVID relief, for example, the push over the span of 4 years to increase the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. What will that do to the economy, both on the street, Main Street, and market-wise? And then secondly, this, you know, I can't do, he said, $50,000 for every student loan borrower, but I can do 10. I can, with an order, I can do a $10,000 student loan debt forgiveness for everybody. What does that do, especially to the banks?
Well, the federal government owns a lot of that. So in many ways, it's the taxpayers who end up paying. And listen, I would be kind of open to a debt forgiveness plan where the actual beneficiaries of all that college money were the ones who were paying. In other words, usually if I buy something from someone and the product isn't very good and I return it, whoever sold it to me takes the hit. Well, that's the universities. So if we want to have a conversation about the universities and their huge endowments and the extremely high living standards for, you know, for hours worked of tenured faculty, and they take a haircut because they kind of did oversell the value of a college education relative to the price, well, that's a conversation worth having. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about sticking it to the lenders, and really, since the taxpayer is the main lender of student loans, because Obama basically nationalized that program, we're talking about sticking it to the taxpayer. So what it does is it creates something called moral hazard, which is people go out and spend money with the idea that it'll probably be forgiven. As for the $15 an hour minimum wage, it's kind of something like that. It's kind of weird because the economic impact is not super big in terms of the overall macro economy, because it affects poor people. And poor people don't have as much pull in the economy. So it's socially really tragic that poor people will never get starter jobs. So the underclass is going to get a little bigger. But in terms of macroeconomic the moving the macroeconomy, it doesn't. But that doesn't mean it doesn't matter. It matters all the more because it's hurting the most vulnerable. It's hurting the people whose individual economies are so small that they don't matter much in the big picture. But they're human beings. They matter in the eyes of God. I mean, they have dignity. They ought to be able to have starter jobs. And a $15 an hour minimum wage is a starter job if your daddy's rich and you live in L.A., New York, Boston. Every place else, if your daddy isn't rich and well-connected and you live in most of the rest of the country, your starter wage is going to be something more like $7 or $8 an hour, which would become illegal. And so you never get started in the labor market.
I talk from time to time. We're talking to Jerry Boyer. I talk from time to time to business owners, small business owners who operate on razor thin profit margins, oftentimes, store owners, restaurant owners, these kinds of things, and ask them what this would do to them and to their overhead. If they have to jack up that minimum wage, their overhead goes up. They're either going to have to, they say, lay people off or cut everybody's hours way back or a combination of then jacking up their own prices, making them perhaps too expensive for the average consumer to afford. So then their business goes down. In other words, they say it's the worst case scenario. Do you agree with that?
That's the most likely. If we actually did this, I think the most likely scenario is a lot of small businesses would shut down and they would be replaced by the giant, the big boxes and the e-commerce companies, which have the capital base to afford automation. So nobody can afford to pay someone more than they produce, right? But a small, little mom and pop shop, and I grew up in one. Boyer Bar and Grill is where I grew up as a little kid. So I understand this economy. They couldn't automate. My Grammy is the one who ran the grill, and my pop pop, he poured the drinks. But gigantic companies, they automate easily. So if I really thought there was going to be a $15 an hour minimum wage, if I was sure of that, first thing I would do is go out and buy publicly traded companies that create kiosks and other robotic replacements, automation replacement for low-skill labor, because that's the main beneficiary.
Do you think that it would also promote an even higher dropout rate, particularly in impoverished school districts, particularly among minorities?
I think for some, but I think most of them won't get that job pushing a broom. I think what you'll have is companies will, there'll be a kind of a minority quota. So there's going to be, let's say you get $15 an hour minimum wage. When we raised the minimum wage before under Obama, you could basically track black unemployment to the rise in minimum wage. It fit almost perfectly.
Coming up, a reaction to President Biden's challenge to the Second Amendment.
Well, what's really interesting to me is the amount of women that continue to outpace men in purchasing guns, in being new gun owners, and being out in the range and learning how to shoot and taking lessons.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Joe Biden's website says he will respect the Second Amendment. It does not say he'll defend it. He likes to say he is working to enact common sense gun laws, whatever that vague term means. He calls high-capacity magazines weapons of war. Yes, this president has issues with guns, and he now has Democrats willing to push through gun control legislation at the top of both chambers and in the majority. I discussed the latest with columnist Selena Zito. You got a pretty big gun store there, Bullseye Firearms Gun Vault. So this is a pretty traditional column, but it's always useful to know what does the gun store owner see. Tell us about it.
Here's the gun store that I focused on, but I went to over 2,000 gun stores. And what, you know, through all of 2020, we saw, people read the reports, the surge in gun sales, but also the surge in new gun owners. Well, that has not gone away. In fact, it picked up so much in 1 month, it broke all records that were all broken last year in terms of new gunner ownership and in the sale of guns. And what that has done has strained the supply of guns, but it's also continued to strain the supply of ammunition. But what's really interesting to me is the amount of women that continue to outpace men in purchasing guns, in being new gun owners, and being out in the range and learning how to shoot and taking lessons. That and African Americans are the big surge right now in people that are becoming new gun owners. But also, what I think is even more fascinating is how much they now recognize the importance of the Second Amendment, something that many of them that I interviewed had never really even considered and sort of laughed at in previous years.
Now, the FBI, you quote, as having reported 4.3 million gun background checks in January alone. So that's 4.3 million purchases. And here's the micro fact. That's the macro fact. Your gun store owner usually has 800 in stock. He's down to 300 weapons. And so that is quite a run on inventory.
Yeah, it absolutely is. What's really interesting is that he said, he's the grandson of a pretty famous gun dealer around Western Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, around this area. And, you know, so he kept a good stock of used guns on hand. And he's just down that nobody's getting rid of a used gun. No one.
And he says that the manufacturer distributor calls up their, quote, special list, and they say, this is what we have for you today. It's take it or leave it. It's sort of like a car dealership when a hot model shows up. You say yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just like that. Luckily, Nathan is one because of his family's long relationship with gun manufacturers. He's on those lists. So he's actually pretty, even considering the times, he's pretty well stocked.
And I'll just close by saying this. So it's because, right, the new surge is because the Democrats won the Senate. So they assume that there is a likelihood of gun control, although Joe Manchin is never going to vote for gun control. So they're never going to get 50, much less 60 votes out of the United States Senate for a new gun control measure. Nevertheless, people see all Democrats and they worry about administrative actions.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And you even talked to a lot of Democrats in there. I think they were most concerned about President Biden saying last week that he was going to make gun control a priority.
Jody Shaw is a recent graduate of Smith College in Pine Grove, Massachusetts. The young, self-proclaimed liberal then became an employee of the school. That's when she ran into a series of issues that led her to take to YouTube to vent her frustration. The effort went viral. Salem host Larry Elder rolls the tape.
Hi, my name is Jody Shaw. I work at Smith College. I worked there for the past 3 years. I also graduated from Smith College, so I'm an alum. And I'm white. And that really shouldn't be relevant, but my employer has made it clear over and over and over again that not only is it relevant, but it's possibly one of the most important, or if not the most important feature of me as a human. There are things going on at Smith that really need to be talked about in the open. This is what I'm asking of Smith College. I'm speaking for the staff who feel similarly to me and don't feel like you can say it out loud. And that's actually part of the problem, is the extreme intimidation we are all working under in regards to race. I ask that Smith College stop reducing my personhood to a racial category. Stop telling me what I must think and feel about myself. Stop presuming to know who I am or what my culture is based upon my skin color, because you don't know that. You don't know that about anybody except for yourself. Stop asking me to project stereotypes and assumptions onto others based upon their skin color, because that's what you ask me to do incessantly. I'm not going to do that. I don't think it's right. Stop telling me young women of color have no power or agency in this world, because that's not true. Stop telling me that young white women have power and privilege over everyone else. Equally not true. Stop demanding that I admit to white privilege and work on my so-called implicit bias as a condition of my continued employment. Stop telling me that as a white person, I am, quote, especially responsible for doing the work of dismantling racism. Stop emboldening students to act abusively towards staff by refusing to hold them accountable for their own egregious behavior. Lastly, we have the right to work in an environment free from the ever-present terror that any unverified student allegation of racism or any other ism has the power to crush our reputations, ruin our livelihood, and even endanger the physical safety of ourselves or our family members. I'm a human being, and I'm a valuable member of the Smith College community, or at least I used to think I was. I believe my value lies in the quality of my work, the goodness of my deeds, the essence of my character, and the fullness of my heart, not my skin color.
She's resigned. Wrote a letter to the president, explained why. Because of the college's woke culture. She happened to be a white female, self-described lifelong liberal, but that's not good enough. In her letter, she says this, and I'm quoting, "I graduated from Smith College in 1993. Those 4 years were among the best in my life. Naturally, I was over the moon when years later, I had the opportunity to join Smith as a staff member. But the climate and my place at the college changed dramatically when in July 2018, the culture war arrived at our campus when a student accused a white staff member of calling campus security on her because of racial bias. Before even investigating the facts of the incident, the college immediately issued a public apology to the student, placed the employee on leave, and announced its intention to create new initiatives and policies aimed at combating systemic racism on campus."
To hear the entire segment with Larry Elder and more from Jody Shaw, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up,
we're really moving into a coup situation, a police state situation.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Feminist author Naomi Wolf, like many true liberals, is concerned with what progressives are up to in the Biden administration. And she is speaking out against the alarmingly heavy-handed moves of the current administration. Salem host Mike Gallagher explains.
Here was a tweet back in November of 2020 from Dr. Naomi Wolf. She wrote, "If I'd have known Biden was open to lockdowns, as he now states, which is something historically unprecedented in any pandemic and a terrifying practice, one that won't ever end because elites love it, I would never have voted for him." That's Naomi Wolf, who argues that nowhere in the Constitution does it say business owners and American citizens forfeit their rights if there's a bad disease out there. We're witnessing the evolution to a police state. Listen to author and feminist Naomi Wolf on Fox News with Tucker Carlson.
It's not just that one tweet. I've been writing pretty much every day for months and months about what I see as the terrible crisis that we're in, that we have to recognize. under the guise of a real medical pandemic, we're really moving into a coup situation, a police state situation. And that's not a partisan thing. That, you know, as you say, that transcends everything you and I might agree or disagree on.
Right.
That should bring together left and right to protect our Constitution. We're absolutely moving into what I call step 10. I wrote a book in which I pointed out there were 10 steps that would-be tyrants always take when they want to close down a democracy, whether they're on the left or the right. They always do the same 10 things. And now we're at something I never thought I'd see in my lifetime. You described it really, really well. It is step 10, and that's the suspension of the rule of law. That's when you start to be a police state, and we're here. There's no way around it.
She's right. There is no way around this. Do you agree with her assessment that we've witnessed tyrants trying to shut down a democracy under the guise of COVID? This was one of the most powerful 5 minutes of TV I've seen in a year.
I'm in touch with many patriots from all backgrounds and all walks of life who are horrified. I interviewed, for instance, Moms for Liberty, a group of conservative moms in Florida who are mobilizing to try to get schools open. They're so worried about what's happening to their kids. And I talked to a mom, Jen Say, a famous gymnast and activist in San Francisco on the left, who's also a mom, who's horrified. I've interviewed doctors. I've interviewed, you know, ordinary people, restaurant owners from all walks of life who are absolutely unable to even articulate their fear and horror, recognizing that the state has now crushed businesses, kept us from gathering in free assembly to worship, as the First Amendment provides, is invading our bodies, as you mentioned, which is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, is restricting movement, fining us here in New York State. I could be fined $15,000 a day if I gather people, you know, more than 10 or 25 people, depending on where in New York State I live, which is a complete violation of the First Amendment. I mean, the violations go on and on and on. I've talked to restaurant owners who are looking at a sector in which tens of thousands of small businesses have been crushed. And why were they crushed? Not because a pandemic forced them to. There is no real science underlying a lot of these closures. It's because autocratic tyrants at the state and now the national level are creating a kind of merger of corporate power and government power, which is really characteristic of Italian fascism in the 20s. And they're using that to engage in kind of emergency orders that simply strip us of our rights, rights to property, rights to assembly, rights to worship, and all of the rights that our Constitution guarantees.
This is what it's going to take. Normal Americans on all sides of the political spectrum have got to start standing up against these bullies and these tyrants and these doggone dictators.
And when you look back, you know, March of 2020, a lot of things started to move that kind of locked into place a set of policies that are kind of 360-degree, full-on totalitarian policies. So I think a lot of us are kind of in culture shock. Luckily or unluckily, I've been studying closing democracies for 12 years. So I recognized early on, you know, once I realized New York State had emergency powers, I know from history that no one gives up emergency powers willingly.
Right.
They always drag it on and drag it on. And so every month I'm getting in my email an announcement that Governor Cuomo is extending emergency measures. Only from studying history do I know how predictable it is when you start to have elected officials say we are not going to follow the Constitution because there's a pandemic. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say all this can be suspended if there's a bad disease.
I never thought I'd ever cheer from my couch for a liberal feminist in my life. Coming up.
If everyone's wearing masks, I can't really even recognize anyone.
That's right.
And we have no interactions anymore.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It was a year ago January when the pandemic was beginning to take shape. The cases in the United States began to increase dramatically in March, and there were still a lot of unknowns. Schools and restaurants began to shut down in the United States. March Madness was the first big sports casualty. A few of the first day one games took place, and then the rest were canceled. It was the beginning of isolation for Americans. While many are still hunkered down in their homes, others are starting to venture out to live again. David Harsanyi, now with the National Review, discussed the impact on Americans while on the Seth Leibson show on AM 960, The Patriot in Phoenix.
And your column gets into this quite a bit, this whole notion of social distancing, if you will, that affects adults and youth alike. Let me start with someone you quote at the end and let you go from there. Social distancing, Armin Rosen recently noted, is an oxymoron, worse than a meaningless pair of words, an insult to language, horrible to even hear in your own mind. Talk to me about why that resonates with you so much, David.
So for me, at the beginning of this thing, it wasn't much different than my usual life. My family life was different because my kids were home and so on, but I work from home and all of that, so it wasn't that much different. But even I soon started to realize that I had lost connection with my community, or I should put it this way, I didn't realize the connections I did have right. before with my community, right. seeing parents at kids' concerts or just speaking to my neighbors, running across them in the street and speaking to them, things like that. And you begin to lose touch with the people around you, and it's just an unhealthy way for community to function. And I think that there are the repercussions of that are something we should think about, not saying, I'm not making some big pronouncement on whether lockdowns work or not. I actually don't think they do, but I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to be one. But I do see that there are repercussions among, as you mentioned, kids, but also adults who no longer it's like I feel like every time I'm walking on the street, if I go near someone, they act like I'm trying to kill them, basically, mm-hmm. and maybe yeah. that's what they think. And that's not a healthy way for people to interact who live in the same communities, neighborhoods. And
you didn't realize that your neighbors yeah. were divorced and remarried.
That's correct.
That's how you open it. Your neighbors. You didn't realize that you were saying hello to the wrong wife. Am I right? Do I have this right?
No, you have it exactly right. I it's a long story, but, there's wind chimes going off, and I hate those things, and they're keeping us awake. So I called the woman who lived next door to me, and I live in a pretty dense sort of area, and, the house is 10 feet away from me. I called, and I learned quickly that she no longer lived here and that they had divorced a year ago and then remarried. And I was embarrassed, but then I thought to myself, everyone's wearing masks. I can't really even recognize anyone.
That's right.
And we have no interactions anymore. So
we knew it would come. There were scientists who said this would come, the social and mental fallout in the wake of some of this stuff that you get from isolation. It's taken a little while to aggregate the data, but we're now seeing increased suicides, increased alcohol consumption, increased drugs and substance abuse. This wasn't unpredictable. It was just ignorable by too many.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that people were technocrats and, political leaders who are given emergency powers never or don't care they're so obsessed with the virus that they don't think about the trade-off society has to endure when we just lock everything down or tell people to stay away from each other. In certain instances, it doesn't make no sense to me because the risk is not high for certain people in society, and that's just the fact. And the way we overreact and the way I see meltdown when we see a video of someone not wearing a mask right. or someone who decides that, they don't care.
Yeah.
I guess it's a radical position in today's world to say, I don't think that the government, even in the midst of the pandemic, should have the power to shut down a church. And I don't think it should have the power to tell me to wear a mask outside when I'm walking around. Now, if you own a Target and you want me to wear a mask, that's fine. It's your property. But whenever an emergency comes today, we just give up all our rights. It reminds me of Republic-era Roman Empire yeah. when you had a dictator for a year during an emergency who could do whatever they wanted. I'm not sure that that's anywhere in the Constitution that we have that sort of system here. That's not one of the Roman ideas that were taken up by the founders here. And yet, We have now governors for more than a year. No debate, no legislation, no conferring with
No deliberation, no public input.
Exactly, just acting like Cuomo did and making huge mistakes that cost lives and then having no repercussions
for it. Not a pang of conscience about it either in some of these cases, Cuomo being a good one. You said it's a radical position to maybe question some of this. Were you surprised how fast and how many people went along with it?
Yeah, I was surprised. I am surprised. Now, initially, I get it because it's scary. We don't know what it's about.
Right.
We don't know what's happening, and lots of people are dying. So it's understandable. You know, you don't want to overwhelm hospitals. And then it became, you know, even if one person is dying, we can't go outside. So, yes, I was surprised. But more surprised when the government just unilaterally in states decided you can't go to church or you can't go to a gun show or you can't go to school. That were a year later, and we still have those kinds of restrictions. It surprises me, but more than that, it kind of scares me because, you know, every authoritarian ever has used an emergency to gain power, and we create precedents. I don't want to sound like I think like Nazi Germany is around the corner. I don't. But still, you create authoritarian precedents here that will be used in the future. And in general, society went along with it because, you know, we care about each other, frankly, and no one wants to spread a disease. No one wants to hurt anyone. I don't think so. But then it becomes something that is now embedded in how we react to emergencies.
Right.
And I think that is
no panics
scary.
And scapegoats and pitting Americans or humans against one another. These are all the early signs. You write that we are often lectured about how wearing a mask is a preventive measure with no downside. This is a lie.
Well, I think that masks are dehumanizing and degrading. I think that they, again, not some social scientist or anything, but I think that a smile from a stranger means something more than we probably understand in usual circumstances. And I think or any kind of facial expression, that's how we communicate. I've noticed, you know, when I do my runs or I walk my dog and someone passes by me and we have masks on, I have to start to engage in hand movements to relay my thoughts or hello. And maybe that sounds like something that shouldn't be a big deal, but I think smiling at someone means something.
Coming up, Ted Cruz on his ill-advised trip to Cancun.
In hindsight, that was obviously a mistake, and ever since then, the media seems to be utterly fixated.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the Department of Justice opens a probe of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo.
His top aide, Melissa DeRosa, admitted that they misrepresented the number of deaths in nursing homes to avoid a Department of Justice investigation.
Is there a genuine chance he'd be held accountable?
There's an element of the governor that is Teflon.
A look at the corrosive impact of social media.
Everybody seems to be more angry, devouring, polarizing.
And what it's doing to us.
It's shaping us to be people that maybe we never intended to be.
Plus, an extended conversation on the divisive and destructive role of identity politics.
For the left, the world is irredeemably stained.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When Texas experienced a once-in-a-lifetime winter storm, the grid was overwhelmed and, for many in the state, shut down. Those who could get out did. Senator Ted Cruz was one of those. Unfortunately for Mr. Cruz, the legacy media caught wind of it and ran with the story. I recently asked him about the incident. What happened with the Cancun trip?
Oh, look, it was dumb as hell. My kids wanted to get out of there. We'd had 2 days with no power. And so Heidi and I said yes. And we took them to the beach. And in hindsight, that was obviously a mistake. And ever since then, the media seems to be utterly fixated with it.
So, Senator, you said it's dumb as hell. I am curious about one thing. Did either of you say, Mrs. Cruz or Senator Cruz, to each other, this would look bad? Did either of you ever bring up the idea that, oh, gee, our constituents won't like this?
Look, it certainly occurred to me that it would look bad and people would criticize it. At the same time, I'm a dad. I mean, our girls are 10 and 12. I'm on the road nonstop. And what happened, where it came from, is after 2 days with no power, we found out school was canceled. And our daughter and one of her friends pitched to us and to the friend's parents, listen, why are we staying here? Why don't we go somewhere where there's power and it's not freezing? And we were sitting there with school having been canceled, and we made the decision as parents. We were trying to be good parents, and we said, okay, sure. And we checked, and the prices were really cheap, and so we the plane flights, the plane was largely empty, and so we did it. At the time, I was trying to take care of my family, take care of my kids, which is what Texans were doing all across the state. And one of the challenges of public life is that you have responsibility in public life, but you still continue to be a husband and continue to be a dad, and you juggle them both. And often the kids end up on the losing end of that. The hardest part about being in the Senate is all of the time I spend away. I'm in Washington, D.C. today. Heidi and the kids are back in Texas. That happens a lot. And so when we had a window to take them, I made the decision to say, yes, let's do it. It was a mistake. And as I said, even when I got on the plane and was leaving, I started having second thoughts almost immediately. And so I ended up flying back the next day and getting on the first flight I could get on.
Well, Senator Cruz, I'm sympathetic because I've been double-teamed by preteens myself. And there's, frankly, it's like a force of nature. And so I'm sympathetic, but I don't know that the Democrats will ever let you forget this, and I don't think you care. Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Ben Brigman, Harley Eide, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thanks for joining us.